Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, beautiful listeners. It's your host, Tembi Locke. Welcome to Lifted, a podcast that pulls back the curtain on creativity, resilience, and the extraordinary moments when everything changes. My guest is Clancy Miller, writer and pastry chef. Clancy is a graduate of Columbia University who began her career in international development in French Polynesia. Then she had an epiphany. She moved to Paris, where she studied at the Cordon Bleu and apprenticed at a Michelin star restaurant. She returned to New York. She wrote her first cookbook, Cooking Solo, and has contributed to the New York Times, Vogue, The Washington Post, Food and Wine, and Bon Appetit, as well as The Today Show and Food Network. But it is her latest book, For the Culture, which caught my attention. It is the incredible stories of Black women in the culinary world. This conversation is a breath of fresh air. We talk about the idea that cooking for oneself can be a gift, and how baking can be a form of political expression, and that post-college exploration is essential. Clancy is a breath of fresh air, a trailblazer, and the kind of woman that you can stop on the streets of New York City and just say hello to, which is exactly how we met. The following conversation was recorded before October 7th, 2023. Clancy Miller, welcome to the Lifted Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm happy to be talking with you.
I am so happy to be talking with you. I have to tell the story of how we met, as I like to say, in the 3D, because I was in New York for press for From Scratch, and I met a friend in the Village, and I'm sitting on a curb, you know, drinking sparkling water because I felt hot and flushed and a million things were going on. And I see this woman crossing the street, and I was like, I tell my friend, I was like, that's Clancy Miller. And she was like, really? And I was like, no, that's, she was like, well, you should go say hi. And I'm like, I'm not that person. I don't stop people on the street and say hi. And also, it's New York. Like, that's completely uncool. So she said, you need to do this. And I was like, you know what? I go, Clancy, of course, you have no idea who I am. You're like, oh, hi. And I told you, you know, I like you. Can we take a picture? I think we took a selfie or something. That made my day. It was so serendipitous. And I'll tell you what was lovely about it is because I came to know your work during the pandemic. And I was one of the early supporters when you crowdfunded for the culture, which we'll talk about. So you were someone who lived for me in the digital space exclusively. And so it was just, you know, the happenstance that I would see you on the street and do something brave and out of my comfort zone, like stop you on the street and be like, hi, let's take a picture. It was really wonderful. And you were gracious, beyond gracious.
I love that moment so much. And you made my day too, because I was like, nobody ever says my name on the street. I'm not like Oprah Winfrey or, you know, so that was a fun moment of like, a person knows me. And then you were so sweet. And I was so excited because you were telling, this was just before From Scratch was about to enter the world on Netflix. And I, after that, I literally got onto my family group chat and I was like, okay, we have to stay tuned. Everybody be on the lookout for Netflix From Scratch. I just met the woman who wrote the book and like produced the show and she's awesome. And yeah, so it was a lovely encounter for me too.
Well, it's funny. I feel like, and you know, I guess we're just getting right in there. It feels like that is something as maybe because we're both Black women, I felt that sort of a kind of a kinship. And we obviously write about food and think about food. And there's that sort of commonality as well. But you strike me as someone who's incredibly open. And as I've learned more about you and I've learned about your work in the world and the way you really believe in and not only have been the recipient of great connections, but also foster great connections in the world and in the food world and connecting and amplifying women's voices. And so maybe somehow I just knew that about you and I felt like, well, it'll be okay if I say hi to Clancy. But I've come to know, and certainly as I was, you know, learning more about you to prep for our conversation today, just how incredible your path has been to being here now. And so, you know, I know you've written, you know, Solo Cooking, and you have For the Culture, which is coming out, and you're a food writer, you're a pastry chef, you're an advocate, you're a linguist, you've worked in the nonprofit sector, and somehow you've managed to put all of these things together in this beautiful career and a beautiful life. And that's kind of what I want to talk about today.
Thanks. I think of it as a patchwork quilt of sorts. If I could have a visual for my career, it would be a quilt like filled with lots of different textures and colors.
Absolutely. Well, I know you were, so you were born in Connecticut.
Yes.
And then your family moved to Atlanta.
Right.
And then eventually Philly.
Yes.
And you went to school, undergraduate at Columbia in New York City.
Yeah.
So, and your father was a minister.
He's still a minister. He's somewhat retired, but also serves as an interim minister in the Episcopal Church. And that's partially why we moved around a little bit.
And then what work did your mother do?
My mom was a management consultant and executive coach. Okay.
That's incredible because I think we understand executive coaching now as a thing, but like I can't imagine what that was like to have grown up with a mom who was an executive coach. And I would imagine, did she either directly or indirectly sort of counsel you as you're finding your path in the world, you know, because you've taken an unconventional path. And so did you have permission to do that because of the work your mom did?
Yeah, I think, well, my mom definitely has always like given me her thoughts and advice, but both of my parents basically from my birth they've both always been just supportive of whatever I'm interested in and paid attention to what I'm passionate about and also paid attention to, oh, she's no longer interested in that, you know, like piano, for example, which I now regret no longer being interested in, but like they have paid attention to and responded accordingly, like supporting the passions and letting go of the things that are no longer passions. Both of my parents have always like instilled with me the importance of being clear on what you love and seeking that out and following your curiosity or curiosities. And yeah, I definitely am blessed and lucky that at no point were they ever just like, become a doctor, become a lawyer, you know, like just create the mantra has always been, you create your path, you follow your passion. So
that is a gift. That is a gift from on high. I don't know where they got that from, but thank God it's passed through the line and come through you, because I think you you know, you certainly have lived your life with that. I can tell, and we'll talk about that, but also I can see you also doing that in the world, like continuing to follow your passions, and then they amplify others. And as someone who I have had a similar kind of path myself, I can recognize that in someone else. What were those early food memories for you in the home?
Early food memories. Mississippi mud pie was a favorite dessert of mine. My parents, my mom is no longer living, but like growing up, we always went to restaurants. My mom was a fantastic cook and my dad is a great cook, but we have a family of restaurant lovers. So we used to, in New Haven, we would go to the Chart House, and I was obsessed with dessert from a very young age. And Mississippi mud pie would always be what I loved, ate, and most remembered from Chart House. Like, I don't remember what I would have for dinner, but I remember that was always my dessert. So that's a big one. Pepperidge Farm Milanos.
Yes.
Yeah. My mom used to hate that I would say this, but we didn't have a lot of sweets in the house because my mom was a little bit of a health nut. But there were Pepperidge Farm Milanos. And then, yeah, lots of great homemade meals. My mom was really influenced by, she was influenced by my parents' honeymoon in New York City. They ate at Four Seasons and it was this beautiful meal. And my mom decided she was going to become a gourmet cook. And so she got like The Joy of Cooking, the Craig Claiborne New York Times cookbook, anything written by Julia Child, like all of these books. And she started cooking from them. So I always remember eating great homemade meals. Mm-hmm. Sometimes my dad would pitch in, but yeah, the sweets always stood out, and like cookies in particular. And my mom and dad both have sweet tooth. So yeah, those are my favorite memories are of desserts and cookies specifically.
And it sounds like great cookbooks around, and also really good food environments, not just in the home, but outside of the home.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Did you ever imagine yourself having a career in the food industry, food space, either as a chef or writer, as a restaurateur yourself? Or was that sort of, you know, if I met 14-year-old Clancy on, you know, at the movies, would she have said, oh yeah, I'm going to be a chef, or I'm going to be in this business? Or was that something that happened later that you found your way into?
I feel like it came later, probably definitely in my teen years, college and post-college. When I was a kid, I wanted to be the president so I could boss everyone around. And I also wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon because for some reason I had a thing with bones. And I did learn the violin. So I kind of wanted to be a violinist and a cartoonist. So that's childhood Clancy. Teenage Clancy, pre-college, was trying to figure it out. Maybe I wanted to be a doctor briefly, like aside from the surgeon, like I might've still been vaguely thinking about that, or psychologist. But it started to become more of a thing later in my teen years, because we continued to go out to eat. And there's this great, there used to be this great restaurant in Philadelphia called Zanzibar Blue. And it was a Black owned restaurant owned by the Bynum brothers. And it was just so elegant and so beautiful, like kind of French cuisine meets African-American influenced cuisine. And just, it was just a lovely, elegant, stunning place. And I thought, ooh, it would be cool to own a place like this, to create an ambiance that was as special as Zanzibar Blue. So that kind of started entering my mind somewhere in my teen years, like maybe 16, 17. But I didn't really think about it because I didn't know. I knew I was going to go to college and I couldn't quite put together the pieces of how do you do that? You know, like how does college lead to that? How do you do that? So it was kind of an open-ended fantasy/question.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think we're so focused that I have a daughter now who just graduated high school, and that focus on, thank you, that focus on the sort of functional career path. Like, what is the path that I can predict, that I know? And although it sounds like your parents were not like, hey, you need to go be a doctor, I think you certainly, if you wanted to be a president, a bone doctor, I think, did you say a cartoonist? I can't remember.
Cartoonist. Okay.
So that is someone who has a wide variety of interests. And that's a brain that is incredibly creative and active, right? You're already not limiting yourself. If you're telling me that those were your early formative desires and impulses and curiosities, I can see the unfolding, right? So you're at Columbia now, you graduate from Columbia. As I understand, you went to work, you studied languages. What did you study?
I studied French. I had studied French from the age of 12 or 13 on. So middle school, high school, college, studied abroad in France. And then I also studied Arabic in college. Yeah.
And so you finished Columbia and you got work with an NGO, correct? Mm-hmm. What was it? What was the name of it?
So I worked at American Friends Service Committee, which is a Quaker organization in Philadelphia. And they work on issues of peace, issues of, you know, kind of economic development, social justice issues throughout the world. And I was working on their Middle East desk for a wonderful woman, Kathy Bergen. And I think I had met her at a party. It was at the home of a friend of my parents. And I was just out of college and excited about everything, and told her I'd studied Arabic and, you know, I majored in history and kind of minored or had a specialty in African-American history, but also Middle Eastern history. And I was passionate about Palestine and the issue of peace between Palestine and Israel and all this stuff. And she was fascinated. I think she was into the fact that I was really interested in the region. And she had an opening and she let me work for her. And so I basically was doing research on Palestinian refugees, and she took me to the UN for a conference that she was having. So it was a very like exciting way for me to kind of tap into some of the things I had been learning in school and to feel like I was able to apply a few things to life, to the world, to work.
And meanwhile, as I understand, you were following, so you have this day job, right?
Yes.
Working with this organization, and then you are following your curiosities, right?
Yes.
In tandem, meaning you are taking acting classes and film classes and cooking classes and dancing classes because they interest you, they lift you, they excited you, you were curious about them. I think you've said before, it was kind of like a choose your own adventure.
Exactly. It was really, I knew I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I figured I have these interests. I can name many of them. Let me do kind of an adventure of trial and error and see what sticks. So, you know, for example, for film, I enjoyed doing screenwriting, but I also thought, oh, I should probably learn how to make a documentary or learn how to edit film. And I took an editing class and I hated it. And so I thought, this is kind of unfortunate because I still do love film. That could be continued in a different way. But I just decided, okay, film's not for me because I can't stand editing. Clearly it's not for me, which was premature. But, you know, the acting I was also really into, but I was also like, I don't know how I'm going to make a life out of this. But the cooking, that was something that made instant sense because you're making things with your hands. And so, you know, I took cooking classes, loved it. I was very excited that, you know, you come in, you haven't made the thing. By the time you leave class, you've made a thing. It tasted good. It looked good. And so you officially can make a thing. And so I ended up getting a job, I guess, job/apprenticeship at a restaurant in Philadelphia. I first was trying to get a job as a waitress there. And the chef was like, you have no experience, but I'll let you be a prep cook on the weekends. And that is where it all started to click, because I could, it was very simple what I was doing, but it was so satisfying and so great to be a part of a team of people. And you see that you're helping to contribute to the meals that all these diners are going, customers are going to enjoy. And like, you have done a thing, you have made a thing, you've contributed to somebody's happy moment. I asked my chef kind of for advice, you know, and she said, you don't have to go to culinary school to be a chef, but I would recommend it if you want to be a pastry chef. And that was another kind of light bulb moment, because I love sweets and I really wanted to go to school for something. I had also applied to business school, which was hilarious.
That's hilarious, because you have a lot of business acumen. You actually have a lot of business acumen, whether you went to business school or not. But anyway, continue.
Thanks. But yeah, I applied to one business school, Wharton, which is hilarious. I just like, I'm going to apply to the best. Boom. And it didn't get in. But I, like I said, I wanted to go to school. I realized it would be more expensive for me to go to school in the US. I started looking at schools and it was expensive. And I just realized I would probably have to take out a loan. But at Le Cordon Bleu at the time, it was less expensive. And I was living with my parents. I got an extra job. I saved up my money and I did the pâtisserie program at Le Cordon Bleu in Paris. Yeah.
Okay. So here you are now, you're a Black American woman, you're in Paris, you're studying at the Cordon Bleu, you are making a life for yourself in France. Yeah. And you begin to work in kitchens. Okay, let's talk about, first of all, what that expat, or I should say, you know, transcontinental experience is like, right? As a Black woman in France. I have an experience in another country, in Italy, but you have that experience in France. And a lot of people just like, they fawn over the idea, the very idea of like that, you know, sort of wish fulfillment of going to Paris, having this fantastic life. You did it.
Yeah.
But you're also working.
Yes. Well, okay. So I should tell you this. So I studied in Paris when I was in my junior year, the spring semester of my junior year in college. And I actually had a terrible time. Terrible.
Why?
Oh my gosh. I had a wonderful roommate who was also at Columbia, Nancy. So it's Nancy and Clancy living together. And Nancy was having this dream experience. She had a cute boyfriend. They had a great relationship. I did not have a boyfriend. I was kind of a little anxious and slightly sad. I was a little bit broke. Like I didn't have my regular work study job. And even though my parents sent me money, I didn't have my like extra money for my little job. And I was a little bit lonely there. And I had my first anxiety attack. A dear friend of mine in college died. Like it was also the weather's terrible in Paris, at least in that moment in time, it was terrible. So I was I had some nice times, but it was not a happy time.
You were like, I'm happy to leave at the end of the semester.
Yeah. I was just like, I'm good.
Bye, France.
But I made a promise to myself that I would come back and I would do it better and I would have a great time. So my going back to Paris really was me making good on my promise to myself that like, I'm going to have a do-over. I'm giving myself a do-over and it's going to be fabulous. And so it was like my first year in particular, like while I was a pastry student at Le Cordon Bleu, it was a fairy tale. First of all, I went over with more money because I had lived at my parents' house. I'd saved up money. Like I was on a mission and I finally got the boyfriends. Like I like ended up having a fabulous romantic life. Like it was such a robust romantic life. And it was just like, it was great. I met great friends. I had made friends because I'd lived in Paris before. So I was able to reconnect with old friends. I made new friends. Everything was clicking. Classes were great. Love life, great. Friends, great. Like even my solitary time, it's just like, I'm just practicing being a French person. So, or like the French Clancy. And so like, it was beautiful. It was a fairy tale. It was for year one fairy tale. The working in, after I started like getting a full-time job, it became a little bit more real. There was definitely a certain amount of hazing that went on. Whether that was, I definitely got my butt pinched a couple of times. And then just gross things like having to clean up certain things that I should not have had to clean up, but it wasn't all terrible. I mean, there was definitely a lot of flirtation, definitely a lot of unnecessary, just kind of like vulgar stuff. And I'm not a prude when it comes to language, which is childish, but
yeah. Kissing culture can be that way, whether you're in France or not in France.
Exactly. But there was also kind of like a sense of camaraderie once I, after a certain point of just, you know, going out for drinks with everybody after work or, you know, just random chit chat. When I first had my stage in the bakery or the salon de thé / bakery, I was thinking, oh, I'm going to open up a bakery or salon de thé in the States, in New York or Philadelphia. And I'm going to use all of my French savoir-faire and have the cutest place. And then that kind of, eventually I let go of that because I started realizing what it meant to work 12 hours a day. At least at that time, I didn't see how one could be in the food world and not work those kind of hours. It just seems like this is the amount of time it takes to make food, or specifically to bake. And, you know, you just, it's not an 8-hour day, it's a 12-hour day. And it sometimes might be even longer. And at a certain point, I realized that I was always tired, you know, like, and it, and I realized I'm very young and I'm tired. And I'm a healthy person and I'm tired and I'm in my 20s. So if I feel this way, given my good fortune and young age, how sustainable is this? And then I ended up getting a job. There was a job opening at Le Cordon Bleu in their recipe development department. And that was perfect timing because I knew I wanted to stay in Paris. I think I was trying to figure out, I knew I wanted to stay. I didn't know if I wanted to stay long term, but I knew I loved it. So it allowed me to have a proper job, a proper salary, be in the food world, learn something new about recipe writing and other stuff. And yeah, so that was kind of a good transition for me.
I know that your first cookbook.
Cooking Solo, yeah.
Cooking Solo. Tell us about the sort of origin story of this book, the idea of it, how it came about. I love this idea. And it's funny, I came across this book at a time in my life where I was doing a lot of solo cooking. What I mean by that is Sato had passed away, my late husband. Your book, for me at least, was an invitation to say it's okay. It's actually sacred and meditative and beautiful to cook for oneself. It's not a task, or it's not like, oh my God, I don't have anyone to eat with. It is, I'm caring for myself.
Yeah.
And this can be joyous. So tell us about the book and the origin of the book.
So there are two origins. Number one, it's interesting. It comes from a very joyful place for me because a lot of the recipes are things that I made for myself or played around with when I was living in Paris. And so when I went to Paris for cooking school, it was my first time living by myself ever. I mean, I was just out of school and I had lived with my parents right after college. So it was my first time having my own apartment. And in Paris, I felt very empowered. You know, here I am in my own little studio in Paris. And like, I had these lovely farmers markets around me. So I would go and joyfully buy food because it's just like a field trip, you know, just fun to see all this beautiful produce. And so for me, it was just, oh yay, I get to actually buy this stuff and I can make things for myself. So that's one side of how the book came to be, just joyfully buying food in Paris and experimenting and making things. And then there's the other side is when I came back to the States, I actually wanted to write a memoir slash cookbook about my time in Paris. And I wrote a book proposal and I was so excited about it. And it was roundly rejected by 30 different publishers. And I was super sad about that. And my mom just said to me, you know, Clancy, there's something else right under your nose. This might not be the book for you to write right now, but there's something else for you right under your nose. It's in your own backyard. She's like, you've got these great recipes. You cook great things all the time. She's like, what if she actually may have been the person who recommended that it be focused on single people. She's like, you know, there are more single people than ever. I just heard this thing on NPR. What if you like that angle? So I think tapping into my own experience of cooking for myself, also realizing that at the time, single people outnumbered married people in the US. Like I said, for me, when I first began cooking for myself, it truly was joyful and a means of being creative and giving myself a really great meal and sometimes a very simple meal, but with ingredients that I'm excited about and, you know, just want to eat.
Talk to me about coming to the idea of For the Culture. Tell us what it is. Tell us why you felt it was important to make this book at this time.
Well, I should start off by saying that I didn't know about that many people, period, in the culinary field when I was looking at culinary schools. I had read about Marcus Samuelson. I knew about Julia Child, I think Edna Lewis. And that might have been it, honestly.
That's two Black people out of three. So that's good. That's
exactly. Yeah. You know, I'll count. Oh, Martha Stewart and B. Smith.
Sure.
For sure. But I didn't really. Yeah, I just didn't have that many role models from a distance who I could think of or look to. And frankly, Edna Lewis, I think I learned about after culinary school. So, and then, you know, think of the world pre-2016. There really just weren't that many Black people talked about in the culinary world, you know? I mean, now, thankfully, things have shifted. But I think if you look pre-2016, 2015, you kind of had to do your own homework. And I feel like it's really important to know in general, regardless of race, about the various options that are available to you in any field. But for me, the culinary field. So For the Culture came about because I wanted to, and I want to see Black women and femmes centered more in conversations about food and wine and hospitality. And I want us to know that not only are we currently doing amazing work all over the world, but we actually have so many people on whose shoulders we stand who did the work before we even got here. You know what I mean? Like we're not starting from scratch. We have actually built culinary traditions and they deserve to be honored and recognized and admired. It is a book of interviews with 66 Black women and femmes in food, wine, hospitality. So they're farmers, they're chefs, they're sommeliers, they're bartenders, there are bakers, there are food artists, they're food writers. So it covers a lot of ground. And it's got recipes from the people in the book and personal essays on important culinary matriarchs.
I've heard you talk about baking as a political act. Would you say, or can you tell us why or how cookies, baking can be political?
I wrote a piece for the New York Times on Georgia Gilmore whoa, that was so fun to write, because basically I had to do a lot of research. And they helped Georgia Gilmore, along with women at her church and in her neighborhood, largely domestics. This is in Montgomery, Alabama in the 50s. This is around the Montgomery bus boycott. And they helped to fund that boycott, whereby Black people stopped riding the buses. This is, you know, all against segregation and Jim Crow laws, specifically regarding the buses. Black people stopped riding the bus, but what does that mean? You still have to buy gasoline for the car. You still have to, you know what I mean? They had to, it was so exquisitely strategically organized. And so Georgia Gilmore organized people to bake and sell their goods at hair salons, and even sell their goods in some cases to, you know, white people who were in support of people organizing this boycott. But through Georgia Gilmore and people who she helped organize, all of these domestic workers, not that everyone was a domestic worker, but many were, baking pound cake, you know, frying different foods, selling it, and just funding this whole movement that lasted for a year. That is phenomenal. That is grassroots organizing
at a whole. And that is like, so we don't always, you know, think about something like baking a pound cake as being a part of the revolution, but there's space for everyone to enter into the fight for justice and equality, right? Even if it's baking a cake. Are you guided by a particular core mission or a goal as you move through your career?
Let's see, two things. What is this? I don't know if it's Cornel West who said this or Thurgood Marshall. A person said, justice is love made public, or something along those lines. I may have butchered that. And I guess I fundamentally believe we all deserve love, and we all deserve to enjoy life. You know what I mean? So in that sense, we all deserve justice. And then we also all deserve pleasure. You know what I mean? So I feel like maybe that is my guiding thing.
Well, I can talk. I mean, from the outside looking in, I can see that, because you are, as I said earlier, this intersection of food and creativity, but also activism within that. I mean, For the Culture is a documenting act of advocating for voices that were silenced, for pulling forward so they won't be erased, right? And it is to then share joyously and joyfully that work with us, that we can learn and be inspired by it, right? You've created this beautiful thing. So you are doing that in the world. Who are some of your partnership pillars, women who have lifted you up along the way, who've been like, Clancy, I see this thing in you. We know your mom is one, but, you know, yeah, I see this in you. You need to know this person because they'll help you do that. Who can we give a shout out to on our podcast?
Yes. Number one shout out to my mom, Rose Miller. Ellen Yin is the owner of Fork Restaurant, where I had my very first food job as a prep cook. So Ellen Yin kind of opened the door for me to have a culinary experience that inspired me to want to go to culinary school. Crystal Mack, who's a food artist who started in the hospitality industry and has transitioned to being a full-time artist. She is such a great, she's so incredibly knowledgeable and has so many great big ideas, and she shares them with me and, you know, gives me suggestions that I really, really appreciate.
The people in our lives who are stretching us and expanding us by virtue of either lifting us up and saying, I see this thing in you that you don't see yet, but I see it clearly. Yeah. or people who are there to say, have you thought of this? And suddenly you just shift your gaze, you pivot just a bit, and you're seeing a whole new world and a whole new possibility. It's not even a big, it's not like, hey, go do this whole other thing. It's usually just a micro shift in and within the space that you're currently working in. So I love hearing who those women are and how we can be that for each other. What we're doing with Lifted is pulling the thread at some of the themes in From Scratch. And as you know, one of the themes in From Scratch is grief, it's loss, it's caregiving. I know that your mother has recently passed. My deep, deep condolences to you. I know we've talked about her a great deal. Rose Miller, we say her name. We send her light into the world. She has sent her light in the world through you. And I saw on Instagram, and it just touched me. After her passing, you posted something and you were in the photograph surrounded by friends. And you quoted your father in the caption, "This is dancing with grief." Mm. What does that mean to you? And what did that photo mean to you?
Well, the photo meant something that I truly could not have anticipated prior to my mom's health nosedive, her dying. Was that we would be surrounded by love. We were completely and totally surrounded by our friends and our family. And this is going to sound so weird, but my mom's celebration of life service, the day started hard for me, but I think that was only an hour or two of the day prior to the service. It actually ended up being one of the best days. It was such a beautiful, beautiful day because I think in that photo in particular, I'm surrounded by my family on my mom's side, many of whom I hadn't seen for a little bit because, you know, we're all spread out. And it just meant so much that you could have this unbelievable loss, but also feel so loved and held. I truly, for the first time, understood that phrase when people say they want to feel held. I felt held. And that's what that photo means to me. And I think the dance with grief that my dad is referring to in that quote is that you, when your loved one passes, there are moments of joy. You know, you can have these unfathomable moments of joy and love and being held and supported. And then, you know, the day after my mom's service was a different story. It was very hard for me, you know, but the day itself was gorgeous.
What was that first meal after, either after loss that's, you know, sits with you in your memory, in your muscle memory, in your psychic memory, in your soul memory, that like first meal after a loss, or the meal that you shared after the celebration of life ceremony?
The meal following my mom's service, and they catered the meal for my whole family and our friends at our house. And that meal was so good. It was so good. And I was just thinking, I told my dad, I told everybody, I was like, my mom is at this table.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, she is delighted. This food is amazing. We had pound cake, my mom's favorite cake. The whole family was there. It was a house filled with so many loving, joyful people who were sad, but also joyful. And it was so filled with life. And like, it became a good memory. And that meal that Honeysuckle Provisions catered was a big part of it. It was just fabulous.
At the end of your days, what do you want people to say about you?
Oh.
And what would you want your last meal to be? That's two questions in one.
Oh gosh, that's a hard one. I can't do the meal thing because that's like
too hard.
You know, I think about my mom and, you know, what I have said and what other people have said about her, and she was brilliant and kind, so incredibly kind and so joyful and generous, generous, generous. So I think in life, to be generous truly and to be kind and to really be joyful and know how to enjoy life, that's all I can aim for, honestly. That's what I aim for. So hopefully, you know, every day is an opportunity to be kind, to be generous, and to enjoy life. So I hope that that is part of my, that is what I show to the world every day of my life. I hope that is what people see and that is what people retain.
I love that. Thank you so, so, so much. I co-sign on that. I feel similarly. I have a similar list for myself, but I also know that that is what, that's what you transmit. And I know that's what people will say. So where do you see yourself in 10 years? I know you're going to be doing that series with Ava DuVernay or that movie.
Yeah.
I think somewhere film is in your future, but where do you see yourself in 10 years?
I would like to be at the Oscars, happily partnered and or married with a kid and living between the US and Paris.
Okay, well, if your life thus far has been any indication of you getting what you want in life, I think you will have all of those things. Hey. And I will be there cheering you on. Thank you so much for this conversation. It has been absolutely amazing. It has been a delight. I feel like I've learned a lot. I am so excited that people will get to read For the Culture. They will check out Solo Cooking, Cooking Solo. I always invert them. I apologize. And just know your work and your voice in the world. It's incredible.
Thank you so much. Also, I have to tell you, my dad absolutely loves you. And he wanted me to say, I told you he's a minister in the Episcopal Church. He has preached about From Scratch 4 or 5 times. And it, truly on the family group chat, always talking about From Scratch. I think with my mom, we watched it 3 or 4 times and we all loved it. And we even watched it, somehow we Zoomed and watched it of the 3 times we watched it at least once. Not in the same city.
Oh my gosh. Thank you for sharing that. And please tell your father hello. I feel like his spiritual work has infused you in many, many, many ways, ways that are not direct on or tangible, you know, in sort of straight and arrow ways, but I can just feel that about you. I literally stopped you on the street and was like, hi, Clancy, it's Tembi. Like, clearly you radiate some sort of openness.
Well, likewise.
Clancy, thank you so much for being a part of this fantastic conversation. I have learned so much today, and I cannot wait for the world to read your book, to see your future work, to read your future work. You are a voice to reckon with. You're doing exceptional work, joyous work, important, vital, narrative changing work in the world. And so I thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And thank you for your work. You inspire me. So it's truly a pleasure for me to talk with you. Thank you.
Lifted is developed, written, and produced by me and my one-woman producing team, Celia Cates. It is edited by Jamie Moss. Thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for our next inspiring episode. Lifted is developed, written, and produced by me and my one-woman producing team, Celia Cates. It is edited by